somebody recap us. What's been happened in the book thus far? Yeah, okay, so it starts out the letters. And what's going on with those churches? Good stuff, bad stuff, in between stuff? They're letters from who?
From John, from Jesus.
Well, really, yeah, from Jesus through John. And that's the key, is that this is Jesus to churches. Okay, and so what's the message? Granted, it's somewhat different to each church, but overall,
persevere.
Is Jesus satisfied with them? Is he concerned about them? Is he pleased with them?
Mostly concerned.
What's the warning over and over again through those seven letters? Well, five of the seven, at least. Yeah, you're going to lose your kingdom. And we forget that sometimes. You know, we disagree with Calvinism doctrinally, but in practice, we don't take seriously the possibility of losing our place with the Lord. And yet there it is. And what's reminded, by the way, as well, is in several of those letters where congregations are threatened with losing their candlestick, losing their standing, yet you still have some among you who have not soiled your robes. It is possible to maintain individually your right standing while the congregation as a whole is not collectively where God wants it to be. And by the way, you see that in the Old Testament too. All of God's people go into exile, and yet there were individually people who were guiltless but suffered with the wicked. I'm thinking about people like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, men of whom the text says nothing ill about their lives or how they've been living, but they're in exile with everybody else because sometimes you suffer as part of a sinful group, even if you're not participating in the group's sin. So, all right. So here's the interesting thing then about the book as far as that goes, is, and just one of the things we want to remember as we go through the quarter, and at the end of the quarter, one of the big takeaways, the vivid vision of what we typically think of as the book of Revelation is given to those Christians represented in those seven letters. To Christians who were themselves, in many of the congregations, flirting with worldliness and compromise, if not outright apostasy, who were certainly tempted to give in to the pressure of a culture that was growing hostile toward them. Antipas has already been put to death in one congregation. Part of the message is, as Dan's already reminded us, persevere. But again, what's interesting is usually when you have people who need to be encouraged and comforted and persevere, in our therapeutic society, what do? We come and we say comforting, nice, happy things. And the irony is, what does Jesus do? What's Jesus' spiritual medicine? Hey guys, it's dark out there and it's going to get darker. Persevere. In fact, one of the key words, we haven't seen it much yet, but this language of, you know, usually translated, I like orange, overcome, if you can even see that in that, I'll change the batteries on the marker. It is a little bright. Overcome, if you can even read my chicken scratch, which by the way is the Greek word Nike, from which we get Nike. It does not mean just do it, it means overcome. And that's literally what Jesus says to those who overcome, to those who persevere through. And so it's interesting, you know, we come to church wanting to be told it's okay and be told happy thoughts, even if they're simple and shallow. What Jesus does is the exact opposite. He tells them the truth about how dark, it's actually far worse than you thought, actually, is in one sense what's going to be one of the takeaways from the book when you really stop and think about it. And yet, it's far worse than you thought, but what? In the end, I win. And so I have overcome, you must overcome. And so, you know, Jesus is a straight shooter with his people. Here's the vision of what's really going on, and it's actually far worse than you thought, and it's going to get far worse for you on earth than you thought. Truth, not shallow comfort. All right, and so up to this far in the vision, what's happened? First week in the class, we looked at kind of 4 and 5. What happens there? Yeah, and what's going on? Praise. Yeah, yeah, the four living creatures, the cherubim, and then the 24 elders representing, you know, we've done enough Bible numbers now, right? 12 and 12, 24, all of God's people of all covenants, they're there. Worship's going on, but what breaks up the worship? What kind of stops all the singing? The one who sits on the throne does what? holds out a scroll with seven seals on it. And next thing you know, John's crying. Everybody's crying. Why is everybody crying?
No one worthy.
John starts weeping because no one is worthy on heaven or earth to open this. Well, I mean, listen, if it's God's business, who alone has the right to get into God's business? No created being does, spiritual, invisible, or you and me, which, by the way, goes back to stuff like Deuteronomy 29, the secret things belong to God. We got to learn, folks, that it's just not ours to know sometimes unless God wants to reveal it to us. Boy, is that hard to accept. So no one's worthy. John starts weeping, and then he's told, wait, there is one. Who is it? Yeah, the Lamb. Or actually, before that, though, it's actually, he's described first as the Lion of the tribe of Judah, right? And then John sees what? A lamb, but standing as though it had been slain. Boy, is that a vivid image, isn't it? And of course, we get what that image is all about. What's that image represent? Is this the Son before the incarnation, or is this Jesus after the ascension? This is after the ascension. That's why he's saying there is one who's slain. This is one who has beaten death, who has suffered in the world, just like the saints under the altar, has suffered in the world, but has already received the reward, which is the resurrection to eternal life. And so he stands there, and he is worthy. And so there's a song, Worthy Art Thou, that we sometimes sing in our auditorium, for real. Exact same music as they have in heaven. No. But the spirit of the words are there. And that's maybe all the more next time we do sing that song, you'll appreciate all the more where that that song takes its inspiration, even some of its language from. The song that is sung when the Lion of the tribe of Judah, who is in fact a slain and resurrected lamb, takes the scroll from the hand of God. And what do we talk about? What's the scroll? What's the idea of the scroll? What is the scroll? What does it represent? Yeah, God's message, God's will, God's plan. Remember, like in Ephesians 1, God has this eternal purpose that he has made known, the secret things, the hidden mysteries. God, what God is up to that he can reveal when he wants to. And so the Lamb starts breaking those seals. What are some of the patterns we saw in the seals that kind of prevail through all the sevens? The seven seals, the seven trumpets we're going to look at in just a minute, the seven bowls of wrath down the road later in the book. What kind of patterns prevail in these sevens that we talked about?
Anybody?
Okay, yeah, so yeah, yes. It's not happy stuff. There's this general structure of four related things, and then five and six and seven with an interlude kind of sticking there, here and there. And so the four, what are the four things in the seals? The four, what's their common eye? They are all, it's the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as they're sometimes called. And they, to Diane's point, kind of represent, just kind of militarization and war and an economic hardship. And ultimately, what's that fourth horse seem to be? Death itself. And these are things that God uses in the course of human history to run the world, to bring judgment, to stir things up, to set limits to human arrogance. Nebuchadnezzar's big in his britches, and Belshazzar follows until what? Until a rider on the white horse goes out, so to speak, and they're conquered, right? And God puts Babylon in its place with Cyrus and Darius and with the Persians and the Medes, and so God does that. And sometimes economic collapse is God's means of putting humans in their place. Inflation goes up, and supply lines collapse, and am I reading the Bible, or am I reading the paper right now? I don't know, but you see how this works. And isn't it ironic, if you go back and again, you look at that third horse, man, where it's economic setbacks. It's the daily necessities that are hard to come by, but the luxuries are still there. The rich never really suffer. It's always the common people who pay the price, but don't touch the oil and the wine. Jeff Bezos is not going to suffer no matter what happens. That's how this works. And so it's always been. All right. And then we get to the interesting stuff. What happens in the fifth and sixth seals? Anybody remember? What's the fifth and sixth seals? Yeah, and what's there? That's kind of the almost the center point, the animating thing of the book. What's going on with them? Yeah, they got a question. How long, God, are you going to let this go on? Because how did they get to that spot? Yeah, they were put to death. For what reason? Because they're Christians. Because they told the world the truth, just like Jesus told the world the truth. And what did the world do to Jesus when it told it the truth about itself? They killed him. And so if you're one of Jesus' people, your very life, regardless of what you say in one sense, tells the world the truth. And the world's going to hate you too. Jesus warned about this. By the way, a lot of the ideas, I don't know if you've ever thought about this now, but go back and read John's gospel very carefully. You can see a lot of the themes and ideas in Revelation. John's gospel is unique among the gospels, and those, a lot of those themes, Revelation and the gospel, fit neatly together. Think about John chapter 3, you know, where this is the judgment of the world. Light has come into the world, and the world hated the light and preferred the darkness. Why? Because if it comes into the light, its deeds are exposed as evil. Elsewhere, if they've hated me, they'll hate you. A lot of Jesus' speech to the disciples very much resonates with the dynamics of the saints under the altar, for instance, here. Go back, and if you've got time this week, read John's gospel. And think about a lot of the stuff that he says there in terms of the same dynamics that Revelation plays with and teases out. All right, and so that question really is what's driving the book. When is God going to set things right for his people? That kind of connects back to the seven letters a little bit too. Think about it. Yeah. Who's going to be one of those souls under the altar? Antipas. How long are you going to let this go? Even if we don't die, you know, we suffer, we're persecuted. How long, Lord, till you do something about this? And so they're asking the wrong question, right? Because the how long is a question of what? It's a question of when. When are you going to do something? And God doesn't ever answer the when question in the Bible. That's what's frustrating. God doesn't care about time. He's the great I am. Time is a part of creation, and it's just not a factor to God. But he will tell us a little bit more about what and why. He will tell us what he's going to do about it and give us not a full answer to why, but a glimpse of maybe why it goes the way it does, in the sense of why he allows it to go on as long and the way he does allow it to go on. All right, so that brings us to the sixth seal. What happens in the sixth seal? Judgment. Yeah, judgment. The sixth seal is almost an answer to the fifth seal. The fifth seal, you know, 1 through 4, this is how God runs the world in the fallen world. He uses human sin and human ugliness against us, the fallenness of the world, to judge us, to humble us, to put us in our place, to maybe turn us to seek him. I think about in Deuteronomy when Moses tells Israel that the hardships of the wilderness were God's means to test your heart to see if you would really follow him or not. The fallenness of the world in and of itself is meant to humble us and push us back to God. So yeah, sixth seal is really kind of a summary of a lot of the other judgment scenes in the book. The answer is, I will judge. And so you have a lot of classic Old Testament prophetic judgment imagery kind of slammed together there in that seal. And God basically says, judgment will come. But before judgment comes, before that seventh seal, we have that great interlude, right? The sealing of the 144,000. This is not the makings of a cable show, a religious TV show. This is 144,000, a form of the number 12, right? All of God's people are marked by him. I mentioned last time, we'll see it more as we keep getting deeper in the book. The quarter goes on. Everybody in the book gets a mark, actually. You either get God's mark or you get the mark of the beast, but everybody gets a mark. And it's kind of like I remember growing up as a kid. When I went to Disney World as a kid, back before all this biometric and RFID technology and smart bands or, you know, whatever. I forget they changed the names of them all the time, but whatever. I remember as a Florida kid growing up, and we go to Disney World all the time as Florida residents because that was our birthright. Grew up 45 minutes away. We'd go in October when the rest of y'all were in school, and we had the parks to ourselves. It was glorious. When you'd leave the park for the day, if you planned on coming back, they'd stamp your hand with this ultraviolet, like ink. And so to get back in the park later, because that's what we could do as Floridians, I'm just flaunting it as much as I can right now, you'd hold your hand under a UV light. And you know what happened when you hold your hand under a UV light? The mark of the beast. No, not really. But they would see that you had been marked. It was not a mark that was visible as you went about your business, as you know, went off site to go get cheaper food or, you know, go take a nap or whatever, because again, as Floridians, this is what we could do. But when you put your hand under it, there it was. It's kind of like what's going on here. If you're a Christian, you've been marked by God. You don't look any different, but in heaven's eyes, you bear a mark. And just as so, when you participate in the world in certain ways, you are marked by the beast. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to chapter 13. But you're marked too, and it's not visible now. But in heaven's eyes, it's seen. Or maybe one other example, not Disney World, but in a seasonal example. Remember Dickens, A Christmas Carol. Scrooge is visited by the ghost of Marley. And remember, what's Marley, what does Marley look like, or what does he have on him?
Chains.
And Marley's ghost, you know, he's there to warn Scrooge to amend his life, or else he's, you know, a similar horrible fate is awaiting for him. And Marley's ghost says to Scrooge, "You wear a chain yourself." And remember, Scrooge, you know, and you know, and it's worse than mine, because yours was as bad as mine is now 7 years ago, and you've labored on it since. It is a ponderous chain. Oh, Dickens' language is great. Anyways, but Scrooge doesn't get it. And Marley says to him, "Mine were not visible either until the day I died." And then you know whose mark you really have. So, they are marked. They are marked before the judgment can be carried out. The idea is that even though God's people on earth, if they happen to have the misfortune of living during a season of God's judgment on a nation or a people, you personally have to live through it. And you may wonder, does God really care? Does God know if you're, say, a Daniel, a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Does God know or care? Yeah, he knows. You're not lost in the midst of all that. But God knows his people. And so a great multitude of every nation is marked. God's people are accounted for. And one of the things that's important, by the way, real quick, as we get to the trumpets, and I don't have a... That clock's not working. Anybody know what time it is? Okay, thanks. And we go till 6, right? Okay. Due for what we're about to see in the trumpets, notice at the beginning of chapter 7, in that interlude when God's going to mark, the sixth seal is said judgment. God will avenge his people. However, chapter 7, verse 1, "After this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds." Notice now, "that no wind might blow on earth or sea or against any tree." Not the people, but that nature, creation itself, cannot be touched yet until this marking has taken place. All right, so let's go on now to the seven trumpets. So going from the seals are the revelation of God's ways, God's means, and in one sense, God's purpose. Will God avenge his saints? Yes, he will. And then the seventh seal is open and judgment happens. Moving from seals to trumpets, the revelation of God's intention and God's design, God's ways, to now God actually doing something. Trumpets. What do trumpets represent in the Bible? What purpose do trumpets serve in the Bible? Yeah, announcing. And what kinds of things do trumpets announce?
The birth of Jesus.
Okay, big news. Big news. What else do they, what other purpose do they serve? Warning. What kind of warnings? You're being attacked. Yeah. Yeah, wake up. Yeah, trumpets as warnings. This is the Bible's version of tornado sirens. Always looking for modern analogies or ways to kind of, I remember, you know, y'all used to love the Metroplex too, man. Tornado sirens in the spring, kind of a little eerie some days, especially if you know there's storms in the area. Yeah. And so, trumpets. The trumpets are to warn. Who are they to warn? They're to warn God's people? Who's supposed to be being warned by these trumpets? The people on earth. Humanity in general. And I think it'll become a little bit clearer the longer we read. It's not God's people who need the warning in that sense in this book. This is God's carrying out of his judgment on humanity for hurting his people and rebelling against him. But one of the major ways you rebel against God is you hurt his people. To warn the people on earth. All right, so now verse 6, chapter 8, the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. First angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood. These were thrown on the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees, a third of the grass was burned up. Oh, wait a second. That sounds like chapter 7, the four angels holding back the wind so that what could not be harmed? This stuff. But now, God's people being marked and sealed, God has made sure that his people are identified. What do? We begin to judge not we begin to judge not on people, but we allow natural disaster type things to happen. Sometimes the way God gets our attention is not by doing stuff to us, so to speak, or allowing stuff to happen to us. Sometimes it's stuff going on around you. And so I think back, like, for instance, the book of Amos, back when Israel, the northern kingdom, is getting close to God's limits and God's patience. And among other things, you know, famine and drought. And one of the things that God will say in the early chapters to Amos, you know, one of the refrains that Amos are there is, as God lists the various things that have happened, like drought and famine, and yet you have not returned to me, and yet you have not returned to me, and yet you have not returned to me. Those judgments in the form of drought and famine and such like were not meant in one sense to destroy them. What were they meant to do? They were meant to warn and wake them up. Sometimes even in the fallen world, God's providence, God's kind of general providence, the way he runs the world, bad stuff happens to even get worldly people to stop and think, hey, there's a higher power out here. I better figure out who he is and what he wants. And so the warn, pot shots, you know, warning shots across the bow, wake you up. And so the first trumpet blows. And some of those images, hail and fire mixed with blood, what do those kind of remind you of, that kind of language?
Plagues.
Plagues on Egypt. What was God's original intention as those plagues went on? There were 10 plagues. Oh, there's a symbolic number now in our new biblical Bible code numerical literacy. 10 plagues. Oh, there it is. But what, you know, in theory, after, say, the fourth plague, if Pharaoh let God's people go, what would have happened? Would there have been 10 plagues? No. What were the plagues supposed to do as each one happened? What were they supposed to do to Pharaoh? Open his eyes. Plague after plague. And in theory, after the first plague, what did God want Pharaoh to do? Let my people go. And he doesn't. So second plague comes. Not a full catastrophe, right? Because, you know, I mean, you start with water, the blood, but it's not forever. It's just, you know, make you a little thirsty, wake you up. You know, and then you got the frogs and the flies. These are annoyances and inconveniences and mild setbacks. They're not meant to destroy you. They're meant to wake you up. And they... Yes, ma'am.
And show God's power.
Well, that's right, and show God's power. And the irony is, what did they actually do to instead the Pharaoh? They hardened his heart. We're going to see that as this progresses. The earth dwellers, that's my favorite translation of the people on earth, the earth dwellers in Revelation, they don't wake up. Instead, they get angrier and angrier. They harden themselves as God tries plague-like. So every time there's a stock market crash, every time there's a supply chain collapse, every time there's a famine or a drought or wildfires, don't look at it as God's trying to judge or destroy some specific person or state or community from some specific sin. What are all these things always meant to do to any of us with eyes to see? Repent. Repent. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm stepping out.
Okay. Yeah.
But hardened Pharaoh's. Mm-hmm. And you can watch, for instance, the first two miracles were things that his own wise men could do.
Yep. No.
And God knew that.
Yep.
And
yep.
He chose two miracles,
yeah,
that didn't impress him.
Yeah.
Now why? He was hardening.
Well, and again, testing where your faith is. By the way, we do the same thing today, because when we have problems, we call it, well, global warming, or we try to have some sort of scientific explanation or some sort of economic explanation for why this happened. That's the modern equivalent of Pharaoh's magicians repeating it, by the way. The human dynamics never change. You know, what happens when bad stuff happens? Well, we turn to the experts, and the experts will do what? The experts will explain why and how this happened and how we can avoid it again. The problem is, one space shuttle blew up in 1986, and the experts worked on it and fixed it, and then in 2003, what happened? Another space shuttle got torn up in a different way, because humans never learn. You're never going to completely master this planet, the world. You're never going to have so much science and so many economics experts or so many medical experts. You're going to get this all buttoned up and have it under control. And yet we keep on like ants. Remember when you were a kid? Well, maybe it was just me and my dark, boyish, perverted heart. But you remember the anthill, those of us who are boys, kick the anthill, you like to crush the anthill. But what would the ants always immediately start doing again? Rebuilding it. Yeah, humans are really no different. When God in his judgment, or God trying to wake us up, kicks the anthill, what do we start doing immediately again instead? Do we change? No, we just start scurrying around furiously as well, rebuilding our little anthill. We never learn. Second angel blew his trumpet. Something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. If we had more time, I'd go to Jeremiah and look at the imagery that's set up there of God's judgment on Babylon, and where this language comes from, but we don't, so I'm not going to do it. But I want you to notice the number here right now. A third. A lot, but not a majority. Enough, again, not meant to wipe you out, meant to wake you up. And the third angel blew his trumpet. A great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch. It fell on a third of the rivers and the springs of water. And by the way, again, notice over and over again, it's not so much the people that are being hit. It's creation being disrupted, nature being disrupted, things being disrupted, right? And so now it's a third of the rivers and springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood, and a third of the waters became Wormwood. Now many people died from the water because it had been made bitter or poisonous, right? Wormwood is kind of a poisonous, bitter wood and fruit. Fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened. In the Bible, darkness is always a judgment, except when darkness is used to refer to God. And by the way, when darkness is used to refer to God, people get confused sometimes. I thought God was light. Yes, but in God's case, when he is described as a deep darkness, the idea is of how unknowable and understandable he is. God of his fathomless. You know, when you get into darkness, anybody ever, Mammoth Cave in Kentucky or Carlsbad Caverns out in New Mexico, anybody ever been deep in a cave and they do the whole turn the light out thing? That room could, or that cavern could be as small as a broom closet or as big as, you know, whatever, and you'll never know in that kind of darkness. That's how God is a deep darkness, mysterious, unfathomable. You can never get to the back of it because there's no way to know. But when God brings the darkness, that's judgment. That's a withdrawal of himself, right? If God is light and God says, let there be light and so forth, when things go dark, that's God withdrawing his presence. And we forget that it's not miraculous for God to be literally present constantly in every facet of creation. He created the work that way. That's not miraculous. That's just how it works. I think about a line in the Psalms where the psalmist says of God, if he withdrew his spirit, we would return to the dust. That's not miraculous. That's just God sustaining us every moment of every day in every way. So darkness comes, and a third of the day might be kept from shining. Likewise, a third of the night. Now, here's the thing. Verse 13, then I looked and I heard an angel crying with a loud voice as it flew overhead. Oh, we finished our four patterns of God kind of smacking nature in different ways. Not hitting, the people who die in the first four are more almost like they're damage, collateral damage to God's disrupting nature. That makes sense? You see that? Okay. And so that's kind of what holds the four together. God allowing bad, you know, kind of natural disaster and calamity, disruption of creation that's meant to wake you up and show his power, to Glenda's right and wise point. With that pattern of four up, then I looked. Here comes kind of the break. This is not the interlude yet. This is but the break that kind of separates one through four from five and following. I looked and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth dwellers, at the blasts of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow. What are trumpets supposed to do? Trumpets are warnings. And these trumpets are sounding the alarm of what God's going to do, because just like seals 1 through 4 are intensified in 5 through 7, it's about to get more intense. Fifth trumpet sounds, and the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit, otherwise called the abyss, abusos in Greek, which is where we get our English word abyss. And he opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace. And so, by the way, understand something. Some sort of spiritual being has come down, and he's been given a key to the abyss. Does that even sound like a happy place? That's kind of like in the Princess Bride, right? The pit of despair. In general, pits and abysses are not good places. And he's given a key, which means that it's under control up to this point. But when somebody's given a key and they use it to open, what happens? You let loose whatever's in there. What's in the abyss? He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened from the smoke of the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions on the earth. And they were told, now look at the reversal here, verse 4. Now they're told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only who? Those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Now you don't touch nature. God's not going to work so much through natural disaster and calamity. You know, the droughts and the famines and the wildfires and the pestilences of life to get your attention, to say, hey, we need to get back right with God. This world is desperately broken and we need to get with the one who can fix it. No, now these creatures that are coming out of the abyss are told, go after those, but not just anybody, only those who don't have the mark of God. Now that's an important hint as to what we do with these creatures that we're about to, and they're really awful and terrifying, and they're meant to be. But what to do with them? They're told to mess with the unmarked earth dwellers. So whatever these things are and can do, they can't get you and me. Now that's interesting, because you and I, can we suffer along with everybody else in natural disaster? You know, if there's a second coming of the Black Death, are you and I going to be protected from it specially just because we're Christians? If the stock market collapses 1929 style here in this coming year, you and I going to avoid suffering with the rest of the worldly Wall Street crowd when the economy collapses with it? Nope. And yet whatever these things are, they're told to leave natural disasters out of it, but have a field day with those who are not marked. So that's interesting. Even in this world still, whatever these things are, they can hurt the earth dwellers, but they can't touch you and me. Now, stop and think for a second, maybe even to begin getting a reminder. We'll read a little bit more here in a sec. You think of other places in the Bible where spiritual beings are allowed to hurt people on earth, but only up to a point or within limits. Yeah, that's a perfect example of this. What goes on there, chapters 1 and 2 of Job? Is there a spiritual being who, if allowed to, can hurt people on the earth? Yeah, what's his name? Satan. And can he, if God allows him, even affect you and I physically, apparently? Job would say, yeah, he can. Can he mess with your money? Take away everything you have if God permits him. But can he only do what God allows him to do? Because even when God allows Satan to hurt Job physically, what does God tell Satan he cannot do? You can't kill it.
Is that kind of like Peter?
Yes. Peter said, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. And what's implied in all that is, and Jesus and I have prayed for you that afterwards, and by what's implied, that's scarily if you're Peter, you're the one connect the dots. I prayed for you that afterward, or that your faith might fail. What does that mean? God's told Satan, go ahead. That was not a reassuring message if Peter was able to connect the dots in what Jesus was saying. Satan knows who you are, just like he did Job, and Satan wants to mess with you. And apparently God has said, yes, but up to a point, only up to a point, because I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and when you are restored, you know, look after your brothers. Not good news if Satan knows you personally and knows you by name and wants to talk to God about you, because apparently, not just Job, but even for others like Peter, what does God sometimes say? Yeah. And by the way, did Job ever know about that? Not that scripture ever reveals, and you and I may not either. But this is how it works. And so, spiritual beings that are allowed to let, evil spiritual beings allowed to and let loose sometimes, but only up to a point. They can only do as much as God allows them. And so what's the limit that these creatures are placed under? You can only hurt who? The worldly, the wicked, the unrighteous. If they're marked as one of God's people, leave them out of it. And so, verse 5, they were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, verse 6, here's what's interesting. The earth dwellers who are hurt by these beings, they will seek death and not find it. They will long to die, but even death will flee from them, because death would be a mercy from the suffering that comes. But even death is not available. Who are or what are these creatures? In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle, and their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces, while their hair was like women's hair. Their teeth was like lions' teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron. The noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails and stings like scorpions. And their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. They have a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon. That's your Hebrew word for that. It's literally, that's actually the Hebrew word, Abaddon. And it literally means destruction or destroyer. In Greek, it's translated Apollyon. Perhaps if you've ever read John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. The angel of the bottomless pit, most likely and rightly to be understood, is Satan himself. Satan himself. What does Satan do? He destroys. That's what he does. Think about other designations, dark designations. In John's gospel, for Satan, he is a liar and a murderer from the beginning, John chapter 8. The gospel of John tracks with Revelation very nicely. The themes and the ideas are very similar. And so John, you know, while Satan is present, like what Jared reminds himself of, you know, that conversation, that's in Luke's gospel. John's gospel reveals the truly dark and sinister side of Satan, a murderer and a liar from the beginning. He is a destroyer, and that's what we see here. What do you do with these? I think, whoa, what God does is God, in a sense, unleashes the evil spiritual beings on those who have chosen to live in the world. You harden your heart, you harden your heart, and you harden your heart, and eventually what does God do? God says, have it your way. This is kind of weird. We're not used to seeing this as kind of a spiritual imagery concept. We're thinking about it as the demons being allowed to let loose. And yet, the New Testament actually, in less symbolic language, teaches this very idea in different ways in several places. Let me give you some examples and actually some very familiar texts, but maybe now you'll see a little bit of what's really underneath it or behind it. Let's start in Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6, beginning in verse 10. How am I doing on time, by the way? I'm kind of scared here. What time is it?
6:48.
Okay, we'll make it. For all the familiarity of the classic armor of God passage, look at it in its larger context. Verse 10, finally be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against what? We just usually talk about sin and temptation generically, but we forget the New Testament. There's a personal evil one who actually means you and I ill and harm. We just talk about it as though it's some sort of disembodied sin and temptation. Well, yes, I mean, you know, there is sin and there is temptation. But where does it all come from and who's behind it? In our modern right-thinking scientific age, we forget that there really are truly evil spiritual beings who are every bit as real as Jesus and the angels. What does 1 Peter say in 1 Peter? He rolls around like a lion seeking whom he may devour. He is real, folks, and he means us harm every bit as much as he meant Peter harm. He's real, and we fight him. And that's why you put the armor of God on, not just so you have some sort of generic, you know, moral uplift against sin and temptation and your own struggles against vice when you want to be virtuous. No, it's much more serious than that. There is a spiritual evil being who is hunting us and at war against us. In chapter 12 of Revelation, he will be revealed as the dragon, or that will become his image, the serpent of old. That's why I tell people, I think dragons are real. The Bible says so. Not the way you want to think of it too often, too quickly, but I believe dragons are real. Why does the Bible pick that image? It's looking for something to put the fear of God back in you about how serious this is. This is real, dangerous, and dark stuff, and it's real. Everybody's real as God, Jesus, and the angels. And so you put the armor of God on. Look at what he says next. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against and under Satan, what? Rulers, authorities, cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. They're real, folks. And listen, just because I don't believe in the exorcist and demon possession in that sense today doesn't mean that they're any less real and out there and working against us. Now you say, how does that work, Jeff, if you don't believe in the exorcist and movies like that? I don't know. It's not my problem to know exactly. All I need to know is that they're real and that it's at work. And I can see the fruits of it in my own temptation and sin and fallenness and in yours too. Right? But that's what's really going on here, folks. A spiritual war. Part of what Revelation is revealing is the unseen realm, and this is real. And what happens in that realm of God does not fully explain how between the seen and the unseen they interact. What the Bible says clearly, whether it's Revelation or places like this, is it's a real interaction, though. And just because Jesus is gone and the age of miracles is over and then the Spirit doesn't dwell in us in that way anymore doesn't mean that this is still not real, even if I fully can't explain or account for it anymore and I can see the mark that I wear. Glenda, you're thinking.
When Jesus left the supper and it says Satan entered.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
What's your comment
on that? I think that... a couple of things. One of the things that happens, one of the things that's interesting about these evil spiritual beings is, they're, again, from the book of Job on, they can only go as far as God allows them to go. That's important. If somebody shows themselves to be hardened in sin and unrepentance, what might God potentially allow? Even Satan himself to have you. Jesus has listened to the preaching and teaching. Jesus has warned, I will be betrayed by one of you, and yet here is Judas doing what he does. What has Judas done like Pharaoh before him? Hardened himself to a damnable point. God alone knows when that point is reached. You and I can't look at a person and say they're that far gone, but God can. And one of the other things that God, you see, is one of the things, principles I see in Scripture is God only allows, in one sense, especially in terms of like demonic possession, stuff like that, in the Bible even, God only allows the spiritual beings to go as far as he himself is prepared to reveal himself in power. And so, for instance, one of the only places that you see actual demonic possession in the Bible is when and where? The Gospels. Why? Because what God allows to happen then and there is because he himself is going to come onto the earth in the person of Jesus. He allows Satan to take that one last best shot, as it were, in a truly frightening way, as he is there at that point in that generation, in those decades, to crush the serpent's head. And so Satan can work in a way that God has apparently never otherwise really, as far as God at least reveals to us, allowed him that long of a leash. But all the more so to say this is the final conflict between God and Satan. And God and Satan over man, because Jesus as the second Adam has come to live the perfect human life in the face of Satan's greatest assaults. And so, you know, it's that great moment in the cosmic war, as it were, when not really, you don't really know who's going to win, but in a sense, in terms of what it looks like, Satan is at his most powerful, his most vigorous, his most active, his most terrifying. And so along that line, go with me to Mark chapter 1. You can do this in other Gospels. I think Mark's Gospel, it's really easy to see this at the very beginning. Look at Mark chapter 1, at the very beginning of how Mark chooses to tell that story. Very first miracle that Jesus works in Mark's Gospel. And again, and firsts are important in stories, because what do firsts do? First establish a pattern or a meaning or what's the significance of this, right? And so Mark chapter 1, the first thing that Jesus does, Mark chapter 1, beginning of verse 21, went to Capernaum on the Sabbath, was teaching in the synagogue. They were astonished at his teaching. Verse 23, and immediately there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and the spirit cried out, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? And who's the us there? The us is the demonic. What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. See, the war between God and Satan is coming to its climax, right? And so the very first time Jesus is even revealed in his true identity in Mark's Gospel is by the demonic, who know why he's here and what he's about, at least up to a point. I know who you are, the Holy One. Have you come? Have you come to destroy us? And what does Jesus do? Be silent and come out of him. I'll reveal myself on my own time in my own way. Thank you very much. And he casts him out. What's Mark Gospel showing us? What's the real conflict? The real conflict is not between God and sinners first and foremost. God has come to offer amnesty to the sinners. We're the collateral damage in a bigger war. What's the real war? It's between God and Satan. That's the real war. Now, a lot of human beings will go to hell with Satan because we refuse to accept God's amnesty in Jesus. But what's the real war? What's Mark's gospel telling us from the very beginning? Where's the real struggle between God and the ultimate forces of evil? And we forget, again, John's language is so important throughout his writing. Revelation is just another form of John's theology in his gospel. And in 1 John, what does John say in 1 John? For this reason he was revealed to destroy sinners. No, that's not what he says in 1 John 3. For this reason he was revealed to destroy the works of the devil. That's why he came, to crush Satan, to put a final end to this cosmic war that's been going on. And we don't understand all the dimensions. The Bible doesn't tell us the story of how Satan really fell or when, or you know, was on the third day, was on the seventh. When were the angels even created? The Bible doesn't tell us that. Don't know. Still don't know everything about this cosmic war that's going on, but just the Bible makes very clear it is, and we're the collateral damage. Adam and Eve were minding their own business until who showed up? And that's why God is angry at Satan, but wants to show mercy to us. Because we're the collateral damage, stupid and foolish and morally culpable. That's why he'll send us to hell if we don't shape up. But it wasn't our idea. Whose idea was it? The truly evil one. All right? So what happens then? People who choose to persist in this, God gives them over to it. Again, other places where this language resonates. Go to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Familiar passage describes the rebelliousness of the human race. For the wrath of God, verse 18, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Just like natural disasters ought to wake you up to, you know, there's a bigger, higher power out here, right? God has built the world in a way that our hearts are literally tested. And even if you never read the Bible, can you look at creation and say, something big going on here. I better get to work figuring it out. Looking for the one by whom, you know, God. That's why God says us, where I'll be found by those who seek for me. Creation is made to test our hearts itself. Even if you never had the Bible, are you looking for him? That's why Paul thought he could do business with the Athenians. What does he see in Athens in Acts chapter 17? I perceive you are most religious. You got all these other gods, altars, but what else do you have? Altar to the unknown God. You're actually seeking. And that's the thing I remind people. The pagans were not as far gone as we are today. The pagans were open to there might be something else and there might be something bigger. We're the ones who think we live in a closed universe after a big bang. There is no God. And we're the ones who are going to engineer and research our way out of this. The pagans were literally more virtuous than we are. We are truly in one of the darkest places the human race has ever gone in our thinking. In modern Western civilization. Yes, ma'am.
We think when all these catastrophes happen, we've done something to the world to break it.
Yeah. And even if we did, it's just God allowing us to catch the consequence, like he so often does, the consequences of our own arrogance. Anyways, keep reading, though, but look at the language here. Again, the language of, God made the world so that you can recognize him in it if you'll open your eyes. So verse 21, although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. We did this to ourselves, and then God just kind of pushes us to the logical conclusion. And so the refrain over and over again, like in verse 24, God gave them up or gave them over, depending on your translation. This is how the demonic hurts us. God allows the consequences for our futile, dark, hardened hearts to catch up with us in all sorts of ways. The consequences of our sin, the consequences of, you know, pick whatever kind of godlessness we individually and collectively engage in. And that's why, in that sense, back in Revelation, those who are marked by God can't be harmed by this. You may suffer with the consequences of a sinful group, but you are not suffering because you are part of the sinful group. Does that make sense? You get the distinction? And that's part of why. So remember back now, back in Revelation 9, what the suffering, the consequences, as God allows the demonic to just kind of run rampant, and it's Revelation's version of, and God gave them over to this evil that they have hardened themselves to accept. What do they wish for but cannot find? Death. What's the modern word for wishing you could die? Suicide. A darkness and a hopelessness that pushes people to suicidal thought. And so, but they couldn't find it. Doesn't mean literally that, you know, I mean, individuals couldn't, you know, get so hopeless and depressed that they take their own lives. But the idea is collectively and socially, so miserable you become nihilistic. Does that sound like what goes on out there anymore? A society slinking further and further into a hopelessness that literally, our birth rates are down. We literally don't reproduce ourselves anymore. Marriage and birth rates are crashing. You know why abortions are down? Not because people are getting moralistic, but because we've given up on having babies. Young men would rather sit in their rooms, forgive me for being so blunt, and masturbate to pornography than actually have real relationships with real women, get married, and have kids. We are literally becoming a nihilistic society who wishes for its own death. It's a scary thing when God blows the trumpet and gives a culture or a society what it says it wants. Woe, woe, woe to those on the earth. All right, see you next week.